All right, as I indicated, joining me here in the studio, we're lucky to have somebody who's going to hang out with us for about 90 minutes or so, is Hadar Avaram. Hadar Avaram is a professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law, where she co-directs the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice and publishes the California Correctional Crisis blog. Her latest book, just out, is called Yesterday's Monsters, The Manson Family Cases and the Illusion of Parole. Hadar Avaram, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio station. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. What a momentous occasion.
A Senate impeachment trial. But of course, there's always that fear that the impeachment, people will begin to tire of impeachment as it goes along. It's probably a natural thing. But the thing I like to say is, yeah, it may be a very deliberative process, a long process. It may be a very boring process. And that's actually how it's in some ways supposed to be. You can't fit everything into a soundbite. This is not something that should be fit into a soundbite or a meme or a tweet even, right? I mean, this is a deliberative process. And I guess the way I see it, I don't know, I want to know how you see it, but for me, this is kind of the Constitution working its way out during very perilous times.
It is. And it might be short, it might be long. I think one of the challenges that we're experiencing, and I just want to acknowledge this because some of our listeners might be feeling this psychological weight experiencing this. It hasn't shown so far any odds of being a serious deliberative process in the sense that there's no actual deliberation taking place. There's a lot of posturing, there's a lot of performance going on, there's very little real deliberation. And I say this for the benefit of the people who felt that the outcome was sort of foreseeable and that they already kind of know how this is going to end. And nonetheless, it's difficult and heart-wrenching to follow through with this just because it's a difficult moment, because the charges are so serious, because this is such a difficult moment in our Constitution's history, that even if you sort of try to train yourself to expect very little from this, nonetheless, it's very hard to follow up.
And you mentioned, and most people believe, that at some point Donald Trump is going to be acquitted. Still never know what happens with witnesses, additional evidence. You never know what's going to happen between now and then. But I haven't heard anyone say that they believe he is going to be convicted and removed from office. So does it matter?
I'm going to argue that it does matter. But it doesn't matter in the ways that we think it does. I mean, the result of this is always foreseen when you're seeing this kind of this partisanship in both houses. And of course, this is something that has become more and more and more extreme over the years. So it was very likely that the impeachment was going to go through, and it was always very unlikely that the removal was going to go through. This is what we're experiencing now. We also know that Mitch McConnell has been essentially gaming this trial from the start, essentially conferring with the defendant about his own trial and cooperating what the Republican strategy was going to be directly with the White House. Even though this is not a criminal trial and it's not exactly a criminal defendant, this raises a lot of eyebrows. And you know, if this was a presidency that was devoid of other anomalies and problems, we would be raising eyebrows. I think at that point, most of us have our eyebrows permanently etched onto our head, so we can't raise them any further. But this is just something that has been going on for quite a while. So the outcome is to be foreseen. Mostly what we're seeing, and I think this very polished presentation by the Democrats of what happened, going in and out of these video clips of testimony at the impeachment stage, is mostly crafted for the 2020 election. So the idea here is to reach out to voters, and you know, it's anyone's guess how many of these there might be, who are genuinely undecided about Trump's guilt, and that might impact the way they vote in 2020, and persuade them that the case is indeed strong, that what happened really happened.
Yeah, and in some ways, I think not only is Donald Trump on trial right now, but perhaps the Senate is on trial right now in the court of public opinion.
Exactly. And I think part of the Democrats' object in this hearing is to communicate to people who might be voting for these Republicans, this is how these people are doing their job. One of the things that has been reported on Twitter and reported by people who are actually in attendance of the hearing, but you can't actually see on your screen, is that despite the fact that the Republicans are required to attend the entire trial, about 20 of them are not actually in the room. And some of those who are in the room are engaged in all kinds of trivial tasks, sort of very performatively trying to show how little attention they're paying to the case that's being made. And I think that the Senate, of course, is not showing the cameras to flash on that. It has been reported on social media. Part of the idea is to communicate to the public, well, this is how your elected representatives care about this historical moment.
Yeah. Now, it is hard to sit in there for 8 hours, I imagine.
It is, but you are in a position of immense privilege, and the least you can do is attend this historical event that might result in the removal of the President of the United States. I don't think it's a tall order.
Do you think impeachment itself is on trial? I mean, here is the third. Now, we've had successful impeachments before, always with judges. Here, though, we're talking about presidential impeachments. This is the third impeachment that we have had, the third trial that we have had. If we, as we expect, there will not be a conviction here. We've never had a conviction for a president, in removing a president. Could that suggest that maybe the impeachment aspect of the Constitution, do you think it's working out the way that it was intended when they came up with the Constitution in 1787? And is it possible that impeachment just doesn't work?
I think the answer to this, I think it's a great question. The answer is pretty complicated. I think that the framers originally wanted to create a vehicle where you could indeed get rid of someone who's abusing their power in a horrific way. And when you look at what the framers originally said about impeachment, you can see some evidence of this. Benjamin Franklin, when he was talking about what impeachment is for, said that it's for situations in which the executive, and I quote, rendered himself obnoxious.
Rendered himself obnoxious.
So all you people looking for T-shirt slogans for the next protest, rendered himself obnoxious. And the
too
idea,
bad that didn't make it into the Constitution.
Yeah, that would have been because, and he's trying to encapsulate a situation where they can't really foresee what form the abuse of power is going to take place. But they're basically saying, kind of like what Potter Stewart said about obscenity, you're going to know it when you see it. Like when your president behaves in a way that's unconscionable, puts their own personal welfare ahead of the welfare of the country, you're going to be able to tell that there's something very wrong going on and this person needs to be removed from office. Now, I think it's a good thing that it's difficult to remove presidents for office because you need to have some order. You can't have chaos and there have to be some controls. I don't know that the framers could have envisioned exactly the shape that partisanship was going to take. And I think previous removal trials that we've had following successful impeachments have really been colored by the question of where the majorities were and where the support for the president was and what the issue was at stake. Not so much whether it's actually a legal crime or not, but is this really serious? Does this really merit removing someone from office and the like? So all of these things factor in. We have to keep in mind that this kind of event is not important only for the purpose of removing the particular person, because the best way to get rid of someone who rendered himself obnoxious is the democratic process. And that's going to happen in November 2020.
Yeah. I guess there's a strong argument that the framers of the Constitution did not, as you mentioned, want it to be an easy process to impeach and convict and remove a president from office, but also did not, and this would pertain today, regardless of how right one might think the Democrats are in trying to impeach Donald Trump, what did not want it to be a partisan affair, hence the two-third vote that is necessary in the Senate.
Exactly. The idea is that enough people of any party, and of course, all of this presupposes that people put country before party and that they really care about the welfare of the country more than about their own seats. So and if that's what's going on, presumably the kind of wrongdoing that would give rise to impeachment would have to be so severe that there would be agreement on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah. And I guess you could make an argument. Now, I think if you can't impeach Donald Trump, who can you impeach?
It's quite hard to imagine a clearer case supported by more robust evidence of obvious abuse of power that is impeachable.
But if you don't have bipartisan support, it's kind of a moot point.
Well, one of the things that a lot of people are finding very disorienting about the sort of constitutional moment, not to use the cliche crisis, but I guess I just did, that we're in right now is the fact that the Constitution assumes that the people who are your elected representatives have at least a passing interest in the welfare of the country. that they're not completely obtuse. And we've seen time after time at these hearings, we've seen motions to bring in witnesses. Since the impeachment decision, since the impeachment vote, we've seen an explosion of new information that supports the story that essentially the impeachment inquiry had. We've seen the Lev Parnas texts and all of the stuff that was implied with that. Oh, that we should all live to see November 2020 and then read the Lev Parnas memoir that's going to come out. But there's been an explosion of evidence. So if you genuinely are seeking evidence and are not really convinced, presumably you would want to see more evidence to see whether there's something to it. What we're seeing here is exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
And the Constitution's veneer of protection is really for all crafted around the idea that people would at least have a passing interest in protecting their country.
It's interesting. And, you know, the previous decade, I was a congressional correspondent. Many of our listeners are like, oh, no, here comes another story about Mitch on the Hill. And it was a time in which things were definitely in the way that politics were working, were in transition and changing. And you could see, you couldn't see Donald Trump, but you could see what was on the horizons of the type of partisan politics that were on their way. But it wasn't entirely there yet. There were still a lot of old timers in the Senate, people like Robert Byrd, who served in the Senate, I think some more than 40 years, maybe even 50 years, if I recall correctly. You know, you had Kennedy, Arlen Specter, and who still prized sort of the art of the deal, who still prized public policy, right? Which take impeachment off the table for a moment. Just public policy anymore seems to no longer be prized as a political outcome. And one thing I saw a lot of contentious congressional investigations, no more so than what happened in Guantanamo Bay. And there were partisan differences on the committees that were doing the investigations about the, you know, what constitutes torture and is this legitimate? Is this, you know, but regardless, almost there are a lot more lawmakers on both sides who are still worried and still wanted to get to the truth of the matter, still wanted to find out what happened. And as I'm watching this play out in the House impeachment inquiry, especially in the House Intelligence Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, what I witnessed from not every single one, but vast majority of Republican lawmakers is they turned into more of defense attorneys trying to find any way they could to get their client, the President of the United States, off.
Yeah. And in that respect, this is looking, I mean, I think your point about partisanship is really well taken, because what we're seeing in the Trump administration is not so much an aberration in Congress. It's the outcome of decades of erosion in these norms of bipartisanship and thinking about policy in a serious way. And I try to see lots of different sides of any situation. But when you see how both sides are responding to this case, it's quite evident that we've come to the logical conclusion that it's very difficult to have a conversation when there's not even a shared notion of what the truth means.
Yeah. In talking about the Constitutional Convention, what was meant? And what was the framers' notion of using the term? Because, again, they didn't use the obnoxious term by Benjamin Franklin. What was the notion of what high crimes and misdemeanors meant?
So high crimes and misdemeanors was never meant to actually mean crimes and misdemeanors.
Yeah.
And we know that misdemeanors are actually low crimes as opposed to felonies that are more serious crimes. The idea was to basically say something very general and very vague about wrongdoing, because both Hamilton and Jefferson and a number of other people commenting at the Constitutional Convention said, we can't really predict what form this is going to take. So we want to have something as vague and as general as possible so as to allow every generation to decide what high crimes and misdemeanors mean at that particular instance. That's what was meant here. So when we impeach the president, it doesn't have to be an actual crime. So it doesn't have to be a federal felony anywhere. It doesn't hurt when it is. And in fact, talking about your point about the Republicans turning into the defense attorneys of the president, one of the points that's being made now is this idea that it has to be a crime, that there's something wrong if it's not a crime.
Well, apparently, that's the argument that Alan Dershowitz is going to make next week.
Well, And I think that Adam Schiff responded to that just yesterday, saying, you know, you couldn't find a constitutional attorney to make this argument, so they had to find a criminal defense attorney to make this argument.
Is that what criminal defense attorneys do?
Well, you work what you can for defending your client. So yeah. If you don't have a lot to work with, you work with the very little that you have. We know that this is not the case. We know that this is very far from having been the case when we essentially impeached the president for having an affair. And not telling the truth about it, which overall, in terms of like the risk to the country, was nowhere near in the order of magnitude of what we're experiencing now. So the idea was to leave things fairly loose and fairly open. It never hurts when there's an actual crime to point to, precisely because of this point that was raised. But you're going to see that a lot of the points that are being raised are sort of these procedural points about the impeachment process itself, because the evidence is very hard to argue with. And if there is an argument with the evidence, it's very hard to countenance why there's not an agreement to bring in more evidence.
Is a high crime abuse of power?
It could be. And I think that the idea is not so much about, you know, grievances in the president's private life, although it does shape up often that the personal and the political overlap. But there has to be some aspect of this that is putting the president's welfare over the republic, over the welfare of the republic.
You're listening to our live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. I'm Mitch Jezrich from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. And joining me here in the studio is Hadar Avaram. She's a professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law, where she co-directs the Hastings Institute for Criminal Justice, also publishes the California Correctional Crisis blog, and is the author of the new book, Yesterday's Monsters, the Manson Family Cases, and the Illusion of Parole. Hadar Avaram, I want to talk to you about how trials work. And again, this isn't your typical judicial trial that's happening in the Senate. I guess part of it could be argued that it is judicial, but it's judicial and it's also political. But I want to talk about the admittance into the record of both new evidence that has been uncovered and come to light since Donald Trump was impeached by the House of Representatives, and to have witnesses as well participate in this. What Republicans have been saying, most of them, there are a few that seem to be open to having witnesses, but what most of them are saying is that the House, that what their duty is just to judge on the investigation that the House is, and what the House of Representatives has found and has charged, and go from that case. It was the House of Representatives that had the responsibility to get these people they want in to testify, that they should have went to the courts and tried harder to get them and the documents that they want. It's not the Senate's job to do it. So there's all these comparisons between an actual judicial trial, maybe even a criminal trial. So I want to ask you how these criminal trials work when you have a grand jury that apparently you can, if you want to make the comparison, that was the work that the House of Representatives did, that of the grand jury. Now you have the trial in the Senate. Is it common to bring in new witnesses during the trial that the grand jury did not hear from?
It's not only is it common, but the structure of the burden of proof in criminal trials is designed to do exactly that. And again, I want to bracket this by saying this is not actually a criminal trial and they could be doing whatever they wanted. So there's something disingenuous. It's not just gamesmanship, but there's something disingenuous about making the comparison. But the comparison also happens to be factually not true. Essentially, in order to charge someone with a crime, and it doesn't matter if it comes from a police investigation or a grand jury indictment, you only have to have probable cause that they committed the crime. So for those of you who like numbers, I'm thinking like 30%. It's less than 50% certainty that the person committed the crime.
Yeah.
But later, to actually convict someone, you have to be sure that they committed the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. So where does the rest of the evidence come in? So evidence can and often does come in during trial. In fact, courts have been very forgiving of prosecutors deciding to proceed with charges with partial cases, saying, you know, they still have a chance to develop the evidence at trial. Very often, this also works to the defendant's benefit because grand juries don't see exculpatory evidence that works for the defendant's side. So everything changes in the course of the trial. New evidence can be introduced that wasn't before. There's no obligation. Nobody's beholden to what happened during the police investigation or during the grand jury phase. Those are investigative mechanisms, and they're very powerful, but at trial, you can bring any evidence that's admissible.
And it's interesting because a lot of these lawmakers, I don't want to say every single one, but a lot of them are lawyers.
So, this comes back to the point I made about gamesmanship, that at this point, with how eroded the truth is, to make an argument like this, it doesn't really have to be true. It just has to be repeated often enough on Fox News so that it becomes a soundbite and people repeat it.
But, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Fox News. I do watch Fox News because I feel like it's part of my job. I want to know what's being said there. And if you want to know what the president's thinking, the Republicans are thinking, that's where you actually want to get it. And it's interesting how influential one person in general is, and that is Sean Hannity.
Sure.
And every night when you watch him during this entire process, he's warning senators, Republican senators, that he will come after them, that people will come after them if they dare vote to have witnesses.
Oh, yes. And just the fact that there's not even a veneer of respectability in this sort of thing is astounding. And I think this might be part of this psychological baggage that a lot of people might be feeling about this process, is that every day you wake up and you think we've hit rock bottom and you find out there's no bottom.
Yeah. Have you now, Hadar, we talked to you in the past because you did a great deal of talking and researching and reading and just overall following the Robert Mueller investigation and then the Robert Mueller report. Have you dived in at all to what we are getting now? It's not a report, but the information we're starting to get from Lev Parnas?
So I've seen some of the stuff that's coming out of the Lev Parnas text, and essentially what you see is not only robust confirmation of the facts that were in the impeachment investigation, but also roping in a few people that were not in the story before. So we're now beginning to hear, for example, about Robert Hyde and how he was mixed into the whole story. So
he's the Republican candidate running for office in Connecticut,
exactly.
I believe.
Exactly. So there's more people who were not part of the original story who are mixed in. Yeah. And this is always the case when you try to craft a narrative for public consumption. You have to tell a story that is coherent, that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But of course, each of these stories has dozens of other people mixed in it that are not obvious at first blush. And now we're seeing lots of people that were instrumental to this that were just not exposed with the previous versions of the story. So we're seeing robust confirmation. I think that if the Senate insists on not exposing us to any of this, we're going to have to wait for the memoir in the hopes that we're still around to read the memoir. So we're seeing some new characters pop up. We're seeing some more information about the discombobulation within government, people trying to convince Trump to release the aid and him being recalcitrant. The importance of this particular point is basically the Watergate question of what did the president know and when he knew it, which is to isolate the blame up at the top rather than making it the blame, putting the blame on the three amigos. We know from the Mueller report that was one of the problems, right? What we saw in the Mueller report was basically a story about a very industrious, very sophisticated Russian machine of hacking and disinformation. And the Trump administration are sort of bumbling but gracious recipients of the outcome of that, without really the money shot of it trickling up to the top, including the very damning meeting that Don Jr. and Manafort took with the Russians, in which they were supposed to get dirt on
Vesnaskaya.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So that meeting, we didn't quite have the money shot, except for Michael Cohen, for how believable that is, that Trump was actually aware of that. The value of the Lev Parnas texts are in tying Trump personally to this decision and showing how personally invested he was in this, when people who presumably are, you know, on his side and trying to bat for him are trying to tell him that that's an unwise course of action.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just watching the interview that Lev Parnas did, especially with Rachel Maddow, and yeah, you know, as you're watching this, okay, this guy's not the most trustworthy person in the world, but everything he says
checks
out
right
with everything else you know. And in an odd way, I asked you before we went on air if you like baseball. I'm going to give it a baseball analogy here. I remember during the height of the controversy over performance enhancement drugs, and Congress got involved and had baseball players come and testify to Congress about it. And the only person who seemed credible was Jose Canseco, reminds me in many ways of Lev Parnas, of you know, this guy is probably, you know, the most gangster of them all, but he's the only one who's telling the truth.
So, I mean, one of the complicated things about dealing with unsavory deeds is that you're dealing with unsavory people. I mean, this is one of the difficulty that a lot of people of goodwill and good conscience have had with Michael Cohen giving information. Michael Cohen is not the shining knight of truth and honesty. One of the things that I used to say when I gave talks about the Mueller report after it came out is that it had two parts, right? Part one was about the Russian infiltration, and that read like this really sophisticated John le Carré spy novel. And then you move on to the obstruction of justice part, and it's like a Damon Runyon short story with Harry the Horse and two-bit mobsters. I mean, you're dealing with unsavory things. You're going to have to talk to unsavory people. It's just part of how it goes. And we've certainly had more of our share of unsavory people in the administration in the last 3 years. So there's plenty to choose from.
Do you think Lev Parnas should testify, be a witness in the Senate trial?
Absolutely. I mean, credibility is a different issue. One of the things that often comes up in the course of genuine trials of legal trials as opposed to a political trial is the idea that every time you want to bring in an evidence or a witness, you ask yourself the question, is this more probative, which is to say, is this going to tell us things that are of value to kind of like solve the whodunit? Or is this prejudicial? Is this going to like bias us? The problem is that things that are probative also tend to be prejudicial because they're probative. So you have to kind of like run a very narrow line between things that are useful and things that are not useful. Because there is a real issue of truth here, you can bring in people and you can talk about their credibility. I think there was plenty of conversation about Sondland's credibility when the impeachment investigation was going on. Here we have somebody who was mixed in with the deal. It's true that he tried somewhat to distance himself from this and sort of have this kind of, you know, I'm one of the guys everybody knew, sort of giggly approach toward it. So not everybody's favorite, but that's one thing that goes into trying to determine how credible the evidence is. Plus, bringing Parnas and putting him on stand would also allow you to bring in a lot of documentary evidence because basically witnesses are not just testifying, they're also vehicles for submitting documents. That's the way trials work. So this means the texts would come in and that's evidence that would be perhaps more credible than hearing somebody narrating this who's trying to save himself.
Do you think that what Robert Mueller laid out concerning possible obstruction of justice. He did not call it obstruction of justice himself, but it's widely believed. He laid out a case for it, for Congress to decide. Do you think that they should have included that, the House of Representatives, in the impeachment articles? And a second question related to that, could they still be used as evidence to show a pattern of behavior in the trial now?
So this is an excellent question, and I think it goes a lot to the difficulty of knowing that you're about to go into a process that's going to be very public, very performative, and which you're basically crafting to appeal to the undecided voters of November 2020. Right? And you face a really difficult choice on how many details you want to flood people with to sort of make the story credible, or how much do you want the story to be simple? And I think sort of isolating the Ukraine story from the bigger Russian story has this advantage of being a more digestible story, right? You believe a conspiracy theory that a foreign country has information that can be useful to your re-election, so you withhold essential aid that risks lives in order to get that information. That's a pretty easy to understand story. Of course, the story becomes more rich and gets more dimension if you also keep in mind that this story doesn't only serve Donald Trump's interests, but it also directly serves Putin's interests. And that it's you can't look just at what happens with Ukraine, isolating it from the general alliance with Russia that sort of lurked around all the 2016 election and maybe possibly procured the results. So this is all part of a bigger story, but when you pick bits of it, you're trying to pick a story that is going to be comprehensible to the public, that people are going to be able to talk to, that they'll understand, again, that has a beginning, a middle, and an end.